And we're live with our 294th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. I'm excited to be back to our regularly scheduled programming after a week in Las Vegas doing all of the things. We're going to get into that shortly. I did want to give a couple of shout outs and announcements in case you have not heard. Well, actually, I don't think we've announced it yet on the podcast, but Ken and I will be teaching a new Black Hat specific course at Black Hat Europe in London. I think it's December 8th through 11th. That is going to be a combination of practical secure code review and harnessing LLMs for application security. So this will be a 4-day course focused on integrating LLMs into application security, specifically how to go about analyzing source code, utilizing those results to do dynamic analysis, doing threat modeling, but realistically a very hands-on practical course about application security in general. And I need to find the link really quick to it because I wasn't thinking about it before now. But I think we've got it here. I will share it here shortly. Good morning. Yes. This is the link directly out of the newsletter. So in addition to that, right, like if you're not subscribed to our newsletter, please go and do so. It summarizes the weekly podcasts. We do newsletters on the weeks that we are out as well. Application security in general, but focused around different podcast episodes that we've done in the past. But I'm really excited about this training. I mean, that's one of the highlights that Ken and I had for Black Hat or for DEF CON, actually, this last week, was the Harnessing LLMs course, doing that in person, and actually seeing people utilize LLMs in an intelligent manner to approach application security. And I know, Anshuman, I'm excited to get to you and you being on the podcast as well. We're gonna have some discussions about how you're utilizing AI, I'm pretty sure. But the course overall, I felt like went very well. And in general, like DEF CON it's always a crazy week. There's a lot going on. Ken, anything you want to say about Vegas before we get to Anshuman's experience as well there?
See Vegas next week on Wednesday again.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. So I guess I'll say hello to Vegas again. Now I'm actually more curious about Anshuman's experience, to be frank. Like, I had my own and we could talk about that next week or, whatever, but, yeah, I'd rather hear more about your experience and let's start with what days was he there? Anshuman, sorry, what days were you there?
Right. Well, let's welcome him to the podcast.
Oh yeah, welcome.
Yeah, welcome. We just went right in, Anshuman. Like you're another co-host. Like it's just great to have you on. Welcome to the podcast, Anshuman Bhartia. And you were in Vegas last week, right? Like we were talking about that pre-show. What was your experience? How long did you spend there and what did you get up to? Oh, I'm not hearing audio from you.
Oh, sorry. I was on mute.
There you go.
Usual. Right. No, I just mentioned, happy to be here. I'm super honored. I've been following both you and Ken for some time. So, it's always good to have like-minded conversations with people. As far as my Vegas trip, yeah, I was there the entire week, August 4th till 9th. I originally went to sort of meet a bunch of people who were attending Black Hat specifically. So that was good, I think. But I think the highlight for me was this thing called AI Security Forum. I don't know if you heard about it or if you sort of went there, but it was basically, I think this thing started maybe a couple of years ago, if I'm not wrong. And I think, so now they have expanded. Now it's happening in London and Paris as well, I believe. And it was a whole day kind of a thingy where they were AI specific presentations. There was, you know, Anthropic's CISO Jason Clinton there. There were folks from Dreadnought.io, though, on the platform for offensive security. And there were a bunch of very interesting workshops as well. So that was, you know, the highlight for me, just because, you know, AI and sort of AI for security and security for AI are sort of themes that I continue to be very interested in, and that an entire day, you know, focused on that those particular topics was very interesting to me. And then outside of that, you know, I met you, Seth, and Ken for the first time. And I had a bunch of other meetings as well. So overall, I think it was a good experience, where it was good to know that people have started to take this whole AI for security and security for AI really seriously. And now their companies and, you know, people just kind of working on their projects. So, yeah.
How did you feel about, like, did you see a difference this year versus last year in terms of just overall? Because, like, I'll just say it. I saw a lot of skepticism the previous year. Are you still feeling the same level of skepticism? Are you seeing anything different? Are you seeing more interesting challenges, or being, sorry, interesting solutions to challenges?
I think, you know, this year, especially going in, I think Google's project Big Sleep or Big Sleep, I don't remember the name, but they, I think, released that they found a bunch of zero days using LLMs. And I think there were a bunch of other announcements along the same lines where, you know, we're finally starting to see LLMs actually being helpful in finding security vulnerabilities, right? So I think those kind of sort of announcements definitely helped take away some of that skepticism. But my general observation was that, yes, I think it's okay to be skeptical, but I think there are ways to sort of actually find real value in this technology. And I think people have started to recognize that. And, you know, there's good and bad, right? Like there were also researchers who gave presentations about how to hack these agents and how vulnerable and how easy it is to sort of exfiltrate mass information, right, at scale. So yes, I think there is good and bad, but I think people who were generally skeptical before, I think they've started to change their stance, at least from my conversations, where, you know, if they aren't able to sort of use AI in their professional lives, at least they've started to use AI in their personal lives. And I think this technology, at least from my personal experiences, you have to play with it to know where it fails and where it works, right? And unless until you do that, you know, you're always going to be just kind of believing what others say or feel.
I guess that's true of most tech, right?
Yeah.
You also brought up a good point. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, Anshuman, you brought up a good point about kind of how, like, the analysis of LLMs, especially in the security space, has splintered a little bit, right? Like, last year, it was just kind of like, how are we using this? How do we break it, right? But there is very definite kind of silos that have popped up. It's like defending AI, right? Number one. Attacking AI, like offensive red teaming engagements, and then utilization of AI. So how do you utilize the LLMs? I mean, obviously, Ken and I have focused in, I think, a lot more on the utilization aspect than necessarily attack or defense, but those are still important. So
that's what I was going to say, Seth. I was like, you know, I spend so much time making things usable and working with these systems and whatnot. They're like, I'm not going to lie, like the idea of just taking the gloves off and attacking instead of using them to defend sounds so much like so much fun and like such a nice change of pace than trying to make things that are like secure and work well and functional and all that. Like, it just sounds so interesting right now, because especially when you dig under the covers, you realize like there is a pretty significant attack surface and there's a lot of things and a lot of ways that it can go wrong for fun. Like, either for meaning, like, it can be very fun. There are obviously real ramifications, but there's also like a lot of fun that you can have, a lot of mischief, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, I guess I get more of that on the third party side, because we are looking at a lot of applications that have now AI, they're AI backed in certain locations. They have like different ways to interact with LLMs. And so prompt injection is a real thing, right? Like, we've got a whole playlist now of, these are payloads that we try out. This is the way that we go about assessing AI security as opposed to like we're utilizing it. But I still think like personally, you know, that stuff's fun, but I get more excited about the use cases, right? Like how we actually utilize it, because I see a lot more kind of improvement there in my day to day that I don't necessarily see just attacking it, right? Like it's one more target, like attacking another target. I've been in the space and I'm too nihilistic, I guess, for too long, right? It's just one more technology to actually go after, and there's nuances to it, right? But the use cases are great there. I'm interested though, the AI security forum that you went to, Antrim, and like, what were the focuses there? Like I kind of looked over it. I couldn't make it happen that day. So I'm interested on your takeaways from you know, the Claude guys, from Anthropic, and what they actually reviewed. Like what were your takeaways there?
Yeah, no, it was pretty fascinating. So I think the conference started off by just kind of giving the state of the art of where we are in terms of, you know, security for AI and AI for security. And then soon after that, I think Jason Clinton from Anthropic, their CISO, he kind of came on stage and he kind of, it was a Chatham rules-based kind of thing, right? So I don't know how much I'm supposed to disclose, but at a high level, the presentation was about how difficult it is for these frontier companies like OpenAI and Anthropic to be able to release these models with some safety ratings. So when I think Sonnet 4 came out, I think the safety rating was ASL3 or something along the lines, right? And I think he just kind of explained how difficult it was to sort of do this a release in a way that kind of aligns with, you know, people who are trying to bring regulations, people who are actually interested in, you know, seeing this technology improve, and people who are also skeptical in the same company, right? And how do you sort of overcome those challenges, obstacles? How do you get the stakeholders alignment, all of those things, right? So I think it was pretty interesting to learn the other side of things, how these frontier model companies decide which model to release, how, when, all of those things. And then after that, you know, there were different workshops. There was one workshop that I attended. This was by the folks at Dreadnought.io. They are basically building an offensive security platform for agents, where if you want to build an agent to, you know, let's say find MCP vulnerabilities, you can essentially use their underlying orchestrator platform to host your agents, you know, so you don't have to worry about building that platform yourself. So I found that very fascinating. And they had a workshop where they came up with a bunch of examples and whatnot. So I think when I saw those kind of workshops and presentations, I'm like, you know, people are actually really exploring, you know, the cutting edge of what is possible and what is not. And then after that, you know, there was this concept in AI Security Forum where if you were a startup or if you were trying to find like-minded people, you could send a request from the app. They had an app kind of a thing, right? Which was very interesting. Like at least all the conferences I've been to, I haven't seen that model work well, but I think they have really cracked it, where I got a bunch of requests from a bunch of people who wanted to meet me. And yeah, I just kind of spent some time speaking to them about what they're building, how we can collaborate, all of those kind of things. So I think overall, I think for people who are interested in this space, I think it's definitely something to sort of go for. And I think they have an application process. I know a bunch of people who applied and who couldn't get through. So I don't know what they look into it. I think I had to send my blogs and whatnot. So I'm guessing they want people who have been playing with this sort of domain.
That's a good heads up. I've actually submitted for a couple other ones too. And yeah, especially I feel like if you're at all, like for you, it's a little bit different. And we'll get into your background here shortly, by the way. We need to hear your origin story, get into what your day-to-day is and all that. But yeah, to your point, like I think it's harder if you're a vendor and you're not a practitioner, right? But that's good to know, man. Like I definitely, because I'm gonna apply. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, if you're already building a company, I'm sure you will get through. Yeah. It was fun. I think it wasn't like a vendor sort of focusing. It was more about practitioners, vendors, you know, just kind of people getting together to discuss important challenges and problems. Like there was also a presentation where I think I don't know his name, but he came and presented about America's AI action plan and then EU's action plan, like the AI action plan, like every region is coming up how they're going to deal with AI, right? So how do they compare against each other? What are good and bad things? So yeah, it was just kind of very good to be aware of those things at a high level as well.
Well, I won't go into, but I'll just say that, yes, like I've definitely had to deal with questionnaires from the EU specifically around AI security. It's usually pretty easy as long as they recognize like right at the very top that you're not considered a critical system. And as long as you're not a critical system, it gets easier from there, meaning like, you know, literally like emergency services or something like that. So I won't go into any more detail, but it's not too bad if you're not doing something like that. Anyway, Seth, did you want to get into Anshuman's background?
Let's do that, right? Like we haven't really mentioned the boring podcast or anything like that, but I would like to know where you, like how you got started, like where, how you came to application security and everything that you're doing, because there's quite a bit of it, obviously, right? Like what got you interested and how did you get into application security?
And I think before I sort of start with my background, I think one other thing about my Vegas trip that I want to plug in is the AICC, the DARPA Cyber Challenge. I think that is something that I don't know a lot of people are maybe aware of, but I have honestly been sort of very interested in the fact that they've open sourced all of their code. So at a high level, there were, I think, four or five different teams that had been competing for the past couple of years in order to build this CRS systems, cyber reasoning systems, where they were supposed to find vulnerabilities in open source software, and they were actually able to issue a PR to fix them as well. And they did find 0 days in widely used software, right? And these teams, all of their code is open source. So I think it's fascinating to understand how they're using AI, if they are at all. And I've been doing my research on it as well. We can go into that, but I just wanted to plug that is if you hadn't heard about it, I think they have a website where they've sort of have all the details about what were the teams, where's all the open source code. So highly recommend looking into that.
I'll post it, because that's a great recommendation, because that was something that was very, very, we both posted it, Ken, but that was something that was very impactful during the,
I'm just going to add to that. I think as an AppSec guy, right, I think what is interesting to me is, this challenge was focused more on binaries. Like if you can use the OSS fuzz sort of harness, we can use the same sort of architecture, so to speak, right, and apply it on application security as well, where we have SAST, DAST, SCA, right? So can we build a cyber or a web cyber reasoning system that kind of uses SAST and DAST in conjunction to actually find vulnerabilities that are exploitable and go and fix them? So yeah, it's very fascinating. I am looking into it. Hopefully I will get to blog about it someday. But yeah, if there are people who are interested in this kind of space, please feel free to reach out and we can all collaborate or something.
Yeah, I just say I love these kinds of challenges just for like proving usability and functionality. It's like, it's so, I gotta say, it's personally very vindicating to watch Expo and the Trilobits and the other teams from that challenge, like just show what's actually possible. It's really, really nice. I don't know. I just have to say that because again, I heard so much skepticism, so much like this won't work. You can't do this. Like it's not, probabilistic. And yeah, anyway, so I just got to say out loud, it's really nice to watch all this, like all these teams have success. And
I think DARPA must have spent $20 million or something on this, and all the code is free. Like they've literally given everything for free, and these teams have $1 million. I think the first team won $4 million or something like that. So this is real stuff. This is no longer hypothetical stuff. Like we are actually finding vulnerabilities, we are fixing stuff, and all of it is getting automated, right? So
Yeah. Anyways. Well, and I know okay. So we're going to get to origin story, but to that point, right? Like I love that it's open source, right? I love that you can go in and actually see how they operationalized, like what they were using. Like you had teams that were dependent very heavily on LLMs, and then you had teams that were not, right? Mm-hmm. Like you had mm-hmm. teams that did basically the, you know, the old, the old way, right? Like they're using kind of AI, but it's pattern based. It's not the, you know, the LLMs that we're seeing or generative AI that we're seeing nowadays. So all of the techniques are in there, and I've spent a little bit of time already into some of those code bases just to see how they operationalize and how they move from one stage to another, because it's fascinating. Ken and I have been saying for a while that the trick isn't necessarily writing a prompt to get an AI to do something. It's how do you get that AI to do it over and over, operationalize it, make sure that it's doing the same thing properly. We were talking about this for 2 days, right? Trying to get students to recognize that, hey, it's fine to play with things, but it's also it's a very difficult process, right? So engineering comes into it pretty quickly.
So
good call out, right? For sure. Like the AI cybersecurity challenge was pretty interesting to see how it progressed. Good. So where did you start, Anshuman? Yeah. Like, what is your background?
So let's see. I'll try to be quick. So I think I've had this hacker mentality ever since I was a child, as far as I remember. I've always been curious. And I think this is something that most hackers, right, they would sort of know what I'm talking about, is in order to break something, you have to first understand how to build it, right? And I think I've had that mentality ever since I was a child back in India. So I'm from India. I came to the US in 2008 to pursue my master's in computer science. I went to Arizona State University. I got my master's degree, and then I started working, right? So, but even, you know, for an immigrant like me to come from India all by myself with no help absolutely whatsoever, you know, there had to be something about this whole sort of career that sort of drove me towards this. So yeah, I've always wanted to become a hacker, right? There were some folks who I used to look up to when I was in India. And, you know, I sort of gradually figured out that if I go to the US to pursue my master's, maybe there's a career for me there. And I think India was still kind of a few years behind America in terms of hacking and like all of these technologies, right? So that's really where my story started. And when I went to school at ASU, I did my sort of master's in computer science with information assurance as my concentration. What that meant was I took a bunch of software security courses, cryptography, mm-hmm. software security, software verification. So I would say my background is very much from academics, right? Where I kind of studied the basics of software engineering, sort of, you know, all of those things. And then this, and I graduated. Hey,
if I pause real quick, sorry, because I just want to make sure I understand this. Okay. So you came over for your master's degree in computer science. Mm-hmm. Was the curriculum, like, did you seek out the software security curriculum, or was that part of the master's? Did you know going into the master's program that you wanted to chase software security, or did this sort of just come into play as part of the curriculum and then pique your interest?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. So even before that, some context is when immigrants or when especially people from India come to the US, they have to give certain examinations. There's one thing called GRE. I don't know if it's still a thing, but GRE is basically an exam there that you get weighted on mathematics, English, and I don't even remember. Anyways, so I think when you get the GRE score, you're supposed to apply to universities, right? I'd applied to, I want to say about 8 or so. I got 7 rejections, one after the other. And then the final the sort of acceptance came from ASU. And that was also from a different campus they had. And that was not even computer science. That was more like computer information systems, right? So I really didn't have a choice. I'm like, I want to go, and I don't know what I will be doing, but I'm just glad to be going to the US to pursue my master's, right? So when I first came here, there was no sort of I wasn't even looking at the curriculum. I wasn't even interested. I just wanted to come here and see what this country is all about, right? And then as you know, as I came here, I started sort of making friends, learning more about the university culture. And then I realized the main campus at ASU actually has a software security focus sort of thing where you can take software security courses. So after a year of spending in the other campus, in the Polytechnic campus, I got my degree transferred to the main campus. And then I started taking, core software security courses. And I think it kind of worked out for me, right? Because I've always wanted to become a hacker. And you know, I was in a university that is fairly known for computer security. The professors were very well known. And I ended up getting into the main computer science degree. So I think it all kind of worked out well, but obviously there was a lot of struggle for me. I think this is also something that you guys might not be aware of, but in India, this is way back, like 2004-ish, right? In India, back in the day when you used to go to school for undergraduate engineering. So I have an undergraduate degree in computer science from India for 4 years. But when I came here, I didn't know how to write a single piece of code. And this is not just me. There are so many people like me who come to the US without having a degree, but they still don't know how to write code. And this is unfortunately the state of education, at least it used to be back in India, where all the degrees were very theoretical. Like I didn't really build anything back in India. So I really didn't know, right? What does code look like and how to build stuff. So for me, coming to the US for my master's and dealing with assignments that were very complex, first year was really bad for me. You know, as an immigrant, as a student in a new place, new culture.
How was language? Like how was the language barrier today versus like back then? I assume you've had practice, right? I mean, almost 20 years.
So. I would say so. Most of my education back in India, English was a primary language. Our teacher, schools, the classes. But still, I think there's that fluency aspect, right? Like, I think I'm a lot more fluent now as I used to be. And then there was also this, you know, thing where before I used to speak something, I used to first convert it into Hindi, which is a native language. And then I used to convert that Hindi into English, which is how most foreign languages kind of work, right? Like you first try to understand in your own native language, and then you convert it into English, and then you speak out. So I think that was, I've been here since 17 years now. So obviously that has changed a lot. That has evolved a lot. I'm kind of more fluent now, but yes, that was a challenge, man. Like, especially, you know, in order to just make friends, right? Being able to comfortably carry a conversation, you know, it is very challenging.
Well, actually, I mean, I would say even like training, when you train somebody, you almost have to remember like using colloquialisms and things like that introduce an even bigger cognitive barrier than the one that already exists trying to learn something non-trivial. So I'm just hearing this and I'm thinking, my God, you went through a lot. Like that was really, really, that's a lot of challenges all stacked up one after the other. But I'm sorry. So you were in school, you're going to class, you're like trying to make it work.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I slogged, man. Like my life as a student here, first year was very difficult. I used to have an on-campus job because, you know, it was expensive. Right, like for people from India to come here, you know, the tuition itself is so expensive. So we have to have an on-campus job in order to sort of help us live on a day-to-day basis. So having an on-campus job, going to classes, struggling with assignments, you know, kind of getting along well with the whole community and culture. The first 2 years, they were actually very exciting, nerve-wracking, anxiety, right? Like anxiety filled, all of those things happen. Anyways, a long story cut short, I graduated, and when I graduated, I think there was a recession going on, and I think there were people, like companies who were hiring, they wanted green cards specifically. So I really struggled. Like I graduated from ASU with a master's degree in computer science with software security, and I just struggled to find jobs in security field, right? So I started off as a cloud technical consultant for this company called Axway. And this was way when, you know, companies were transitioning from their on-prem to AWS, right? So that was a, like, even though I wasn't working on security, just kind of learning about cloud infrastructure, AWS, S3, EC2, right? And that was very interesting to me. And I didn't really care much if it was security or not. I was just happy to have a job and be doing interesting things, right? So that's how my professional career began. And soon after that, I started, I think I spent maybe a couple of years at a foray was, which later got acquired by Synopsys. It was a boutique security consulting company, right? And I joined them as an associate security consultant. So, and I think that's how I got introduced into the hacking industry, right? Like I was doing web application penetration testing for clients. I was, yeah. And then I slowly transitioned my way to more product-based companies, right? From a consulting company. So I worked for Atlassian, Intuit, EMC. I worked for big enterprises. I've also worked for smaller startups, right? And application security, product security is something I've pretty much been doing all of my career, right? So yeah, and now I'm here.
Well, that's so much defense too, with many different sort of like, because an enterprise is very different. So like an Intuit is going to be, you know, incredibly different than obviously a startup, right? That's right. Going to be a different culture. So you've kind of got like the full gamut of different types of programs that you've been a part of. Were you always a part of the software security side, or did you ever dabble in, I don't know, you know how sometimes people want us to be like players in a little bit of another space? Like I've done like some network stuff and VoIP hacking and stuff like that.
So you know, when you work for early stage startups, you have to wear multiple hats. So at a few startups, you know, I was doing cloud security. I did incident response for EMC, where if you ever dealt with an EMC product, and if you found a vulnerability, and if you emailed EMC about it, I was a person on the other side dealing with it. So I have sort of seen both, you know, the defensive and the offensive side. I was also very active in the bug bounty industry, you know, HackerOne, Bug Crowd. I used to attend the live hacking events from HackerOne, right? So yeah, I think I've seen all kinds of domains.
Oh man, those are really, do you ever do like the live ones in Vegas?
And I think that's where I think I saw you, Ken, for the first time when GitHub had a live hacking event. And I think I met you there. Yeah.
I was just thinking, I was like, man, we must have crossed paths at that point. Yeah. That's so crazy. Oh my gosh. That's hilarious. Wow. Well, you've definitely seen a lot of changes, from your first gig, we'll say, till now. I don't know, Seth, do you want to get into like what positive trends, what negative trends, like what's changed? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of directions we can go.
There's a lot of places that we can take this, because it does feel like you've been more embedded in, like you said, like product companies, right? Like you've been an IC, like an individual contributor that is seen quite a bit. You've definitely been in the space for, you know, as long, you know, as Ken and I have been. So I'm interested from your perspective on, like, obviously we're getting into the generative AI phase, but you also host a podcast called Boring AppSec, right? Like, so, you know, you're speaking my language, Crocs and Socks, like the basics of application security. But what do you feel like has changed in application security since you started until today?
Wow. So I think I want to say a lot has changed in the last year itself. I think until last year, right, before LLMs and ChatGPT, things were still pretty much the same, to be honest, right? Like AppSec continued to be this very manual intensive sort of domain where it was more about building relationships with engineering teams, stakeholders, doing manual activities like threat modeling, design reviews, code reviews, right? All of these activities have always been manual, and for obvious reasons, right? There just hasn't been enough innovation yet to do it automatically, reliably, consistently. But I think with LLMs, things have changed. Things are changing. And I think things are constantly evolving now, right? Because every day we learn about a new technique. We learn about a new vulnerability class. And I think I think it's going to be like this. It's going to be in this flux state for, I want to say, at least the next 2-3 years, right? Where I think for the longest time, AppSec engineers have been doing things that could be automated, right? And it just wasn't automated because there wasn't that intelligence layer, right? Like LLMs and whatnot. So I'm particularly excited about this evolution, right? Where if I'm doing a design review, and let's just go with that as an example, right? I don't want to spend my time gathering the artifacts of what to review, right? I just want an initial sort of step where a system can just bring everything in front of me, right? And just ask me questions where, you know, I can actually use my experience and the skills I've gained over the years to be able to answer something. As opposed to, okay, let's see, I need to do a design review. There are a bunch of Jira tickets. There's a conference page. There's this, that, right? So let's kind of go and gather context from everywhere, right? And I'm particularly excited about those kind of activities getting automated and humans being involved only when there's a need for a human to be involved. And I think that's a shift that I hope a lot of AppSec product security engineers start to see in the day-to-day lives, right? Because I'm pretty sure nobody wants to deal with Jira and conference on a daily basis. And that is just something that is part and parcel of any AppSec engineer's job, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's building. We always go back to building context, right? Like about a design, about an application, there's a lot of manual effort that has gone into that. So the ability to push that out off or have something aggregate that for you, even if it's only 90% correct, is still massive from a time and efficiency perspective.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to add, I think, so, you know, I've obviously heard skepticism. I've heard from people where, you know, the first question I get asked is, okay, can you do this reliably, consistently? Can you get the same outcomes on every run? And I think my answer to that kind of, to those kind of questions has generally been, you know, look, you know, if we are able to get from 0 to 80, I still see that as a win. The last 20% is always going to be a challenge where, you know, we continue to struggle for accuracy, determinism, consistency, all of those things. But if you're able to get from 0 to 80 in terms of coverage and in terms of visibility, I see that as a huge win, right? So just kind of knowing for a fact that LLMs are non-deterministic systems, right? That is not a good enough reason to sort of stop using AI or just kind of not wanting to use AI, right? And I think that kind of argument holds strong, I feel. And I hope people see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you calling it an intelligence layer, because I've been struggling to, I want to be able to take a step back and actually like diagram this out. But you're right. There's like, there really has been this massive gap. And it exists. It's true for not just like SAST or DAST or threat modeling or whatever training, whatever you want to, whatever types of things that we do, activities that we do, it's pretty much all of them have the same problem where it's sort of like, we either have some basic low hanging tooling that kind of like, even if you look at training to date. Now I know there are some new players and things are changing in that space, but to date, it was pretty much like, well, we know pre-canned vulnerabilities. We don't know your vulnerabilities. We can't like easily just create on the fly a training that matches like your org's specific sort of code base and the challenges you face and the bug bounty reports you've gotten and things of that nature. Instead, it's sort of like, here's the static thing. And then when you want to do anything more, I'm just using training as an example, a human being then has to get involved. So there's always been in every area that we do our work, I would argue, this huge chasm between here's some basic tooling and then a human has to do everything else. And then there's this now intelligence layer that is between that. And I would argue it's even closer to the human side of the work. And yeah, it's tough to orchestrate things. It's tough to orchestrate things where you get the same sentiment. I always tell people it's the sentiment that matters. It's not the wording. Because to your point, the wording will alter every time. If you can get the sentiment to mostly be the same each time, cool.
Yeah.
which is possible. But even still, even if that's hard for you, even if that's really, really difficult, it's like, yeah, there is an intelligence layer that starts to wrap all of this stuff together and helps us contextualize data. I mean, that's really what it is. It's just an analysis of data in mass in a way that we just couldn't, you know, do before. And I don't know, there's just a lot of applications we're starting to see fall out of all
that. Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so I like the way you said that. It's smart.
Yeah. Intelligence. This is like what's got you excited. Okay, you've been at this for 20 some odd years too, Antrimon. What still drives you crazy about the industry?
I think as an industry, we are, well, I hope this changes, but I think we have been trying to solve the wrong problem, to be honest. You know, this problem of vulnerability management. Do people actually take a step back and think about why those vulnerabilities are introduced in the first place? What was the root cause? And why do we need to deal with vulnerabilities? Because the way we deal with vulnerabilities is also not ideal. We play whack-a-mole, right? There's an idle issue on this endpoint. The next week, there's an idle issue on a different endpoint. And we keep fixing endpoint by endpoint. That is what we call vulnerability management. And I feel like that's the wrong problem to go after. Like if you see an idle issue, at least this is my opinion, and I think that's what I try to at least advocate for in all the companies I work at, is analyze the root cause of it. Let's try to eliminate that class completely so that we should not be seeing idle issues again. Right. I understand it's an idealistic problem. It's a very difficult problem to solve. But even if you take small steps in understanding the root cause, you know, you'll find new ways, new discoveries. And I find that most of the vendors, again, I don't want to bad name vendors because I know, Ken, you have a company as well. But I'm just kind of...
It's all right.
I guess I'm trying to answer your question.
The vendors? No, I'm joking.
Yeah. I think, you know, with this, with new age vendors like Dryrun and, you know, there's like so many out there, I think the approach that you guys are taking is exactly what I would do, right? Where let's try to solve the impactful issues, right? Like even if you're handling vulnerabilities, let's not try to go after secure flags and SSL and this and that, right? Let's go after authentication issues, authorization issues, business logic issues, right? These are the most impactful issues. And these are issues that haven't been easy to find using deterministic SaaS-based tooling, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think that is what really frustrates me is, you know, there are conversations happening, right, where vendors are trying to get in companies, trying to sell their sort of whatever tooling they're building. But the reality is, as the security team, right, as a consumer of those products, it's very frustrating to first, A, get that tool integrated into your current environment, B, extract value, prove ROI, right?
Yeah.
And it's just too much work, and security teams are often less resourced, as we all know, right? So yeah, we just kind of have built this industry around this concept of the more tools you have, you know, the better problems you can solve. But the reality is, I think, different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, there's a challenge I've seen crop up too. Because like, so there's two things I wanted to mention. One was I'll save it. It's more for like product security, avoiding foot guns with like things like IDOR or authentication issues or authorization, whatever types of issues you're facing. But I was going to say one challenge that I'm seeing, because I'm hearing this from people who have, you know, gone previous years with a different vendor and whatever. And like, they bring up a good point, which is actually, it's tough to test, to get the, to be able to test these tools, whatever kind of tool it might be, truly within the window that you have, and make sure that it's actually going to perform well over time. Cause usually your time box, you know, it's set to like run on whatever, like just a couple repos or whatever, like the vendor you talk to is doing. I, you know, I'm just hand waving here, but they say it's really hard to basically get a good evaluation. And so then the problem then becomes you buy something and then you're kind of locked into it. And then everything you just said, which is now you have to make it work, you have to integrate it into your processes, you have to like educate people on it. And it's just a super big pain if you accidentally chose, which it's easy to do, the wrong tool. Yeah. It sounds like a nightmare from an internal perspective. You know,
yeah.
The last time I was at GitHub, we had our own thing that I didn't choose that. So it was different, but yeah. So I didn't face the same challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting that that's what you bring up, because it feels like that's been a discussion point for quite a while. That we have a tendency to focus on the easy things because they're easy things to solve.
That's right.
And I still see dashboards to this day that come out of companies that say, oh, we blocked, you know, millions and billions of attacks against your website. And right. Like, I'm like, guys, it's an Nmap scan. And most likely you're like misclassifying it as an attack. So why are we still talking about this? But we have trained the C-suite and executives to focus on those big numbers and the fact that your tool can eliminate those big numbers down to small numbers, right? And it's an easy concept, I guess, is where that comes from. But to your point, it's not focused on the right things, right? Like we've definitely gone off the rails a little bit.
Yeah.
I love that approach of burning down one category of vulnerability at a time. Like to me, that is such a valuable exercise, especially if it's the thing that just keeps hitting you over and over again. And to your point, like sometimes, and actually I'd be curious about your thoughts on the whole prodsec versus abSec discussion. But to me, that seems like a really good product security function, is that if you can, because like I've seen this before, you all have seen this before, where there's functions and like, meaning like authorization patterns that are not intuitive. And it's pretty, in a more simplistic app, it's easier to prevent IDOR. But in a more complex app that has, you know, a lot of different actors and probably needs a pretty complex level of testing for authorization, you know, period, it can be very, very difficult to avoid those issues. So, you know, like if you can at all write code or help influence the design of code that makes those decorators less confusing, for instance, it's like you can kind of get down to the root cause versus just trying to prevent with rules or policies or whatever. And you can do both and probably should, right? But anyways. Yeah, so actually, what are your thoughts on the whole like application security versus product security space? I'm not sure if anybody's ever asked you this question or...
No, I actually get asked this quite a bit. And I think the definition of AppSec and ProdSec has also evolved over time. I think these days, product security, at least from my understanding and from my conversation with peers, is, you know, it sort of involves aspects of cloud security as well, where if you are sort of building a product and, you know, you're not just building the product, you're deploying it somewhere on the cloud infrastructure, right? So that starts to sort of go more into the cloud security side of things, right? Infrastructure as code, all of those. And I think for a company that is building products, right, like the entire life cycle from the point where the product is ideated to the point where it's kind of designed, built, shipped, deployed, right? The entire thing would fall into product security, right? So yeah, and I you know, I've worked at different companies interpret product security in different ways, right? So at Lyft right now, AppSec is actually under product security, but there are companies where I worked at where AppSec was different, product security was different. So I think, you know, I at least try not to go, you know, too technical into these terms. I think it's about it's about collaboration. Like even if you have different teams, like if there's a cloud security infrastructure, whatever it is, I think what's more important is, are you working on projects that overlap and they're actually solving real problems, as opposed to, okay, look, AppSec is only going to deal with code security, we're not going to deal with cloud. I think that's just the wrong attitude to have, and that's the wrong culture as well. And most of the places I've worked at, I think some of the successful projects I've worked on, you know, they've often overlap, not just AppSec, CloudSec, but also incident response and operations and this and that, right? So, yeah. And that kind of goes to show that security is all about defense in depth, right? It's never about SaaS or DAS or just SCA, right? It has to be a combination.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm with you. This also goes back to the point about like we focus on the wrong things, right? Like,
yes.
Can we classify this section of security as under this specific silo that we've created artificially within our company, as opposed to, hey, everything's got to be secured. So how do we think about it holistically to go at cloud security and application security and the overlapping edges? Because when we forget about those overlapping edges, I don't know, things like the request smuggling stuff happens, right? And that's I know that's been that's been at everybody's top of mind because of Port Swigger, because of the talks that have come out recently. But I go back and forth, right? Like I'm like, yes, that's a it is a security problem. It is application security because it's but it's infrastructure. It's not really custom code. So depending on who in your organization actually handles that, you got to work together on it, right?
And yeah, or like an app that uploads files, but like to S3, but the bucket's not protected. You know, that's like just silly things that that's can happen. It's not having the full picture of it. Yeah.
And that, I mean, that's where the holistic, right? Like, okay, how are we assessing things? How are we testing? Where does it make sense? What is the scope, right? And then when we go in from an offensive perspective, I know I get very heads down because we are in custom code most of the time, right? And it's very difficult to step out a little bit and say, hey, the client wants us to look at this code, but they're running on this really old infrastructure. And we're going to have to call that out because, man, if you can just take over Apache and you can dump all this code, then anything that I didn't find, the attackers are going to find, right? But we do get siloed a lot of times into this is the only thing that we have to look at for compliance reasons or whatever else it is.
Going to ask about your day-to-day actually, like what is you know, you're a tech lead at Lyft, what is your AppSec tech lead, what is your day-to-day look like, what are your responsibilities as an AppSec tech lead?
So it's kind of, honestly, it's kind of all over the place. I have my own individual projects, which I'm sort of just kind of focusing on solely. And I think it's also because our team is really small. You'll be surprised, but the AppSec team at Lyft is only 3 people. And I'm the tech lead, and they're 2 sort of AppSec engineers, excluding the manager. So, and, you know, we've been able to survive, and like we haven't had any major breaches, hopefully. Again, I there's no way to know if there's a breach or not, right? So anyways, I think we do fairly well in order to scale ourselves. And my day-to-day kind of involves, you know, working with other sub teams under in security, cloud security, incident response, and coming up with as I mentioned, overlapping projects that actually bring meaningful impact to the company. I'm building relationships with different stakeholders. So, you know, like for example, MCP, Model Context Protocol, is a thing that our team is concerned about. And teams want to use MCP, they want to build their MCP servers, they want to use external MCP servers, right? And as the AppSec team, it's our responsibility to first understand what the hell is MCP, what are the kind of a risk it brings to an enterprise, right? And then what can we do about it, right? Can we build some secure guardrails? Can we sort of give some guidance on how to use MCP, right? So those kind of projects fall under a domain where I think my role as a tech lead is being more about is about being more proactive and anticipating these risks that will happen, right? Like I know MCP is going to happen, I know agents will happen, right? So as a tech lead, it is my responsibility to come up with projects to start building those relationships with engineering teams and sort of understanding, okay, what are your pain points that you're struggling with? What is it with MCP that you need help with, and what can we do, right? And I think that kind of culture allows me to continue working on cutting edge greenfield, right, stuff that is very interesting, and then B, also sort of take a small team, right, and actually work on meaningful things. Like if we are just doing code reviews, design reviews all day, every day, there's no way to know if you're actually bringing value to Lyft or not, right? So, yeah, that's kind of my day-to-day. And again, like there are meetings, there's roadmap stuff, there's all kinds of stuff, right? So I don't have like a fixed structure. I just kind of go how I feel on a particular day and what I feel should I be working on that day.
Yeah, it does feel like, I mean, like you can be pretty much like an internal consulting resource. You know, you almost sound like the early days, like I would say the glory days at GitHub, where we were a smaller team. And yeah, it was very much like, you know, what am I going to work on today that is going to help, you know, having that autonomy to actually like decide, like, what is going to be meaningful and help? Yeah, exactly. Like, not just, hey, we got to meet this KPI and, so then you've got to hit this OKR, but then you have to do this epic to hit this, you know, it's like, all right, cool. Really exciting. Like super fun. You know, no, it's very cool to instead sit on and consult with the team today because they're about to kick off the design of, you know, a huge feature for the company that's going to move the financial, you know, and the company just generally forward. That's I don't know. I felt that was very rewarding personally. So that's very cool that you're doing that. Do you ever dabble in the bug bounty space at all? Do you?
Man, after I've had kids, you know, after, I mean, if you're asking about me personally,
I meant, sorry, like for your company, like, you know,
managing
yes,
it.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So our team also manages a bug bounty program, by the way. That is also something that falls on our plate. It is a private program and it has been private for a bunch of years. But yeah, we do find a lot of value in our bug bounty program, right? And especially with kind of IDOR issues, authorization issues, those are kind of issues that we only learn about it from our bug bounty hunters. And, you know, finally, we are actually, you know, this is very interesting. And Ken, I think you'll be able to relate it more, is we are able to find IDOR issues finally using LLMs internally before yes. the researchers can, which is the biggest validation, right? It's like, you know, like you'll hear arguments like, look, oh, you're trying to find IDOR issues on code, using models that have been trained on that vulnerable code. But no, I don't think that's true anymore. Like, this is first party code that the LLMs haven't been trained on, and we are finding able to find these issues. So that is exciting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't give away, you've got tons of knowledge, but for everybody listening, I can't give away all the secrets, but yes, you're right. There are definitely ways that even without that training data, as long as it understands the language, you can get to truth very easily, much easier than obviously with like static deterministic tooling, just because it's that intelligence layer, you know. There's just, I keep saying, I feel like I'm just a broken record. I keep saying, like, if you have something that can at least analyze the intention and the behavior of code, then that unlocks just a ton of things from there. Right? Like, that's just the truth. And especially if you piece together the agentic tooling aspect of it, where now there's some autonomy to, speaking of autonomy, to then go out and say like, hey, I think that this needs to happen. I think that this is the plan that's been set forth. So let me go, you know, use these tools that are at my disposal, figure out which one works best for the thing that I need to do, and then come back and, you know, perform analysis. When you do all that together, it's like, it's pretty incredible. And then there's like another thing that, sorry, the last thing I'll say here is that when I get the, like, the, well, because there's a good point to be made that at least with deterministic tooling, you get breadth very quickly, right? You can iterate over 5,000 files in a second, right? And you can't do that with, I mean, let's be honest, you can't do that with LLMs very, very, except for the trick is with agentic access, they can run those tools too. So, they can synthesize the output after having found more meaningful, like, human-like things. So it's just become a very interesting space to like see things that are fairly very complex get solved in a way we never had that.
We didn't have that before. Yeah. And I like that what Anshuman said about and what you talked about, the intelligence layer, like we're inserting an intelligence layer there to actually speed up the analysis. And then combining the intelligence with the deterministic tools that we've used in the past is where it feels like a superpower, right? Like I keep telling people, it feels like a superpower if I can go and have it, you know, aggregate all of this like deterministic information that I already have and give me the top 10 points. And again, if it's only 80% of the way there, that's still 80% further than I made it without, or that it's pushing me 80% of the way to completion and making me more efficient, right? So anyway, cool. Anshuman, I do want to be cognizant of your time. We've already gone an hour. I mean, I know you host things as well, so you probably understand how it all just goes by so quickly. There's a lot more that we could talk about, but I did want to give you an opportunity to just tell us about what you're doing, where people can reach you, like how they can interact with you online or, you know, in other ways.
Absolutely. So I have a couple of websites. My main website is anshumanbhartia.com, but I also have a personal kind of a blog where, you know, I've kind of become slightly like somewhat spiritual in the past couple of years. So I kind of share my learnings, my self-reflection. So if that is something that is of interest, I have a personal blog on like Substack. But my main website, anshumanbhartiya.com, it has all my socials. I'm fairly active on LinkedIn. And, you know, AI for security and security for AI are two things that I think I'll continue working on, at least for the unforeseeable future. So if you find anything that you like in my work, or if you're interested in collaborating, you know, I'm always up for sort of working on interesting problems.
Cool. Ken, you're muted.
Yeah, sorry guys. I was just doing the links and I muted myself so you wouldn't hear the clicky clacks. Yeah, sorry. Anyways, thank you so much, Anshuman, for today and for coming on the podcast. As you can tell, I'm a huge fan. And so it was, just big honor for you to be here today to share. I do feel like there's way more we could even go into. So maybe there's a part two that we need at some point. Sometimes happens. With this hour-long format, it's hard to get into everything. But
I would really like to dig in a little bit more into just like innovate, like stuff that you are doing on a day-to-day basis with generative AI.
That's true.
You know, obviously, like that's very interesting. Now that we've got the background, we've met in person, we know like all the things. Like that's probably the next follow-up that I would like to do. We'll reach out as long as you have time and you're open.
I have time. Absolutely. I really enjoyed this conversation, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on and giving us your time. Otherwise, Ken and I will be back next week. We'll probably talk more about, you know, security and generative AI and all the things. We'll give a wider summary, I think, on our experience in Vegas at that time as well, now that it's settled a little bit for both of us. Anything else, Ken, before we close it out today?
No, just again, Anshuman, I really just appreciate it. Thank you for coming on. And thank you for the listeners and those that view the video. I know we have many more listeners than viewers, but for those that view live, thank you to you as well.
So. Okay. Yes. All right. Thanks all, and we will... Yep, we'll see y'all soon. Thanks.
Bye. Thanks.